Welcome back. This is Henrik. Thank you for tuning in to Red Ice Radio. As you might know, we've been doing some traveling here in the last few days. And before we're back in full capacity again, we have one more program for you to squeeze in here. We have Stephen Greer with us for an hour today. He has recently been involved in the Sirius documentary film that has gotten mixed reviews from praise to criticism. And we're going to hear what Greer has to say about the film today. So stay with us for more. Welcome to the program, Stephen. We spoke once in 2010 for an hour, and it's good to have you back once again. So thank you for coming on and spending some of your time with us again.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate your interest and support.
Well, this has been a very interesting development to follow around the movie. A lot of controversy surrounding the film as well. Sirius, it's called. It's been out now for, I think, about a month or something like that. And before we get to some of that, Stephen, let's hear about this from your point of view first. Tell our audience about the film and why you wanted to make it primarily.
Well, of course, I did make the film. There's a production company that made it. We wanted to have something come out that would educate the public further about three things and what Sirius does. And you can go to SiriusDisclosure.com and actually view the film online. It's a video on demand now available to anybody who wants to look at it. It was to focus on disclosure and the fact that we have enormous numbers of people who have been in the military and government who come forward more than most people realize, and we wanted to feature that as and some of the evidence that goes with it, but then also go into a discussion of what's behind the secrecy. Why would this issue even be important enough to do the kind of, frankly, illegal secrecy that's associated with it? And that enters into this whole question of the technology, the zero-point energy, and even anti-gravity, so-called gravity control technologies. And then the third part of it that we want to focus on is the concept of citizen contact with these extraterrestrial civilizations, the idea that instead of passively watching all this go by, and spending endless hours looking at things on YouTube, people should go out under the stars and engage in protocols to make contact as citizen diplomats to these civilizations, because there is no organized effort besides the one that we launched about 20 years ago from the Center of the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and the CE5 initiative is what we call it, where humans make contact to indicate to these civilizations that are interstellar that there are peaceful, somewhat enlightened people willing to make contact with them rather than clandestine programs that are highly militarized. So that part of the film is to me, the part that, of course, is the most controversial, but is the part that, in many respects, is the heart of what I've been doing for over 20 years, and that is educating people about the reality of transdimensional physics and where that interfaces with remote viewing and consciousness, and how that can be used in contact protocols by a group of people with these civilizations. And that's something that I pioneered about 22 years ago, but began to experience when I was 18 years of age, and a contact experience I had in North Carolina up in the Blue Ridge Mountains. So I think that part of it is the part that most people look at as very futuristic, but I tell people it's only futuristic because we haven't been doing the correct and useful things with these civilizations for 50 or 60 years or more, and the only face that humanity has shown towards them is the face of militarism, weapon systems, a sort of a materialistic approach to the whole problem, which is, of course, the root of the problem. It's that there's a reductionist, materialist worldview that is running the world into the ground, but has also dominated this whole UFO subject for far too long. So we're trying to shed some light onto an area that's, to me, the most intriguing, most exciting part of it. And so that's the whole concept of how individuals can become ambassadors, as it were, from Earth to these civilizations using contact protocols that many people are using or having amazing experiences with.
All right, very good. We'll get into some of the details of this here later, but I wanted to ask you, I've been up to Linville Falls in North Carolina. It was a while ago now, and took a look at the Brown Mountain Lights. Is that connected with the experience in any way that you had?
Well, I don't know. That's something that I personally have never seen, so I'd have to see it to be able to evaluate what it is.
It's right there at the Blue Ridge Parkway, though, I think, right? You can see it from that area, I believe.
So I've been there. I used to live right in that area, in fact. I used to live in Blowing Rock, North Carolina. As far as what is causing that, it's hard to say. And one of the problems is that there are a whole lot of different phenomena that occur that can be misidentified as extraterrestrial. Now, some people say, that's a piezoelectric effect. Well, it probably isn't that because it's been too consistent. There are people who, for example, when we go to Mount Shasta, we've had these luminous objects come out of Mount Shasta and interact with us that come out of the mountain. And are obviously under intelligent control. And yet they're in an energy form that isn't solid. And so people say, well, is that ET or is it something else? And I said, well, most ET civilizations, when they do appear in our space-time, appear in ways that may be like a plasma or an object or an energy field before they fully materialize, but not always. And so it really depends on the conditions of what's happening. And in terms of that specific, area, I've heard reports for years. I've actually been to the overlook you're referring to on the Blue Ridge Parkway, but I did not see those, what you're referring to. I've seen what people have described in other parts of the world, which are obviously been under intelligent control. And that would indicate to me that there is something going on where civilizations have the ability to create energy forms. And one of the reasons I give an example of back from the big wave that happened in Belgium in the late 80s and early 90s, and we went over there, and there were these big massive triangular objects that would appear, disappear, were chased by F-16s on radar by the Belgian Air Force, and the chief of the Air Force, General de Brouwer, publicly said that they had them on radar and were chasing them with F-16s. And they would go vertically straight up at multiples of anything conventional aircraft could do. They were clearly anti-gravity. But one of the interesting accounts that I had when I went over there and we had a contact experience with one of these objects is that it was more in that sort of energy field, but it was giving off this reverberating vibration right above our car up on this ridge at Henri Chapelle. And I later talked to a gendarme, a military police in this little town that had seen one that was a very famous case. And what they had left out of the case, which I found was the most important part, was that it was a sort of what's been seen at those Brown Mountain lights, but a little different, where there was this big, fully materialized triangle over the center of this little village, over the steeple of a church in the town center. At about 10:30 at night, everyone came out. The equivalent of 911 emergency center was just flooded with thousands of calls. And this object was hovering there. However, when I don't know if there were calls, there were jets approaching or what, but at some point, while they were watching, this object that was fully materialized in this dimension, and it was about 800 feet on each side, about 3 football fields, it collapsed into a single sphere of pulsating reddish-orange light, like a plasma or an orb. And that massive craft became enfolded into space-time, just becoming this lit area, and then it shot straight out into space. And they left that out of their report because they didn't think anyone would believe it. And I said, what you observed is the sine qua non of transdimensional interstellar technology, because if it stays just materialized in 3D, it can never go from one star system to another. It has to do this shift into another energy form and then from that into another dimension. And they were just astounded that I said that. But what I have found is that even in the UFO reporting world, the most important aspects of the phenomenon gets sanitized out, for lack of a better word, or left out, because it's so unrelatable to an aircraft landing at JFK Airport or what you would expect. And what I point out to people is that the stranger it is, the more likely it is extraterrestrial. The more it is moving and looking like a conventional aircraft, the more likely it is it's probably an experimental Lockheed Martin or Northrop Grumman anti-gravity prototype, which we do have. And many people will see those and think it's ET, and it's not. And so the issue becomes rather complex.
Definitely. I mean, those in Belgium, at least also I've seen photos of, they look very much like something experimental that humans would make, the few images that are available of that. But that's just my take on it.
Well, some people feel they may have been things like the TR-3B and other prototypes of anti-gravity that are triangular. On the other hand, some of their behavior and characteristics that we saw and were reported were clearly not of a prototype. And this then brings up the question, are both going on at the same time? Now, you know, and so some of those objects may have been ours. Some of them may have been extraterrestrial, and the extraterrestrial may have been observing what we were doing with these advanced systems. Right there where the Cold War and the superpowers had their borders in the late 80s and early 90s, it was a very dynamic period. So there was a lot going on that it hasn't been discussed, and which, you know, we could go into, but that's just one case. The key thing I point out to people is that you can't make, it's sort of like, you know, I'm a trauma doctor, and it's sort of your differential diagnosis of something. And what people want to do is they want to say anything that's not conventional is ET, or it's whatever. And the reality is that there are multiple categories of things that it could be that you have to evaluate. And that's the other thing that I, you know, really enjoy training people and educating people on, because I think a lot of times people don't have any idea that something that they saw could be an experimental anti-gravity human device. Because I'll hear people say, oh, I saw this thing moving like this, and it absolutely couldn't be human. I'm going, well, actually, when you figure that in October of 1954, which is now we're coming up on 60 years, that we have figured out gravity control, and we had operational systems since then that have been highly classified. In fact, there's a videotape of someone, a military spokesman some years ago, accidentally saying the next generation of aircraft that we'll bring out will all be anti-gravity. And that was on the record, and he let it slip. And it was a very interesting accidental comment, or maybe it wasn't so accidental. But what we have found is that most people don't even understand what are in covert human programs, never mind what an extraterrestrial vehicle could appear as. So you have to begin to factor all of those things in, and particularly the ET civilizations, because when you look at the way that you would have to go from one star system to another, there's no way to do that in a straight line, even at enormous speeds. And if you're talking about going what I call superluminal, beyond the speed of light, then you get into this whole area of physics that's transdimensional physics, where you have to talk about what happens when you don't incrementally speed up, but you're in 3D space-time, and in an instant, you resonantly shift over into another dimension to go from point A to B in a non-linear way. So A and B become right next to each other instead of 50 light years or 100 light years or a million light years apart.
Right.
And this area of science is, to me, the most interesting, because it explains a lot of the phenomenon that people experience with ET craft, where when we've been out under the stars, we've had them fully materialized, and we have images of those. We've had beings that are extraterrestrial beings come in a flash of light, and on the camera, the digital cameras will pick up a person just hovering there. And it's a extraterrestrial being. It's actually on our website. And then you go to the point where you can have something in between, where it's partially in this dimension, 3D, partially not, where you might see an orb, or there must be a tonality. And we have often had events occur where we'll be out in the desert, and they'll suddenly be like a crystalline melodic tone that'll come all around us. And everyone will see in their mind's eye the shape of a sphere, even though what they're hearing is a sound. And the sound begins to create a form. And it gets into concepts of dimensions coming into touch with each other and what that might be like as an experience. And then you get into something even more controversial, and that is the fact that consciousness is a non-local field. It's a field that's actually omnipresent and isn't limited by linear space or time. and that these civilizations, as well as humans innately, have the ability to experience that non-locality of the conscious field of awareness. And that, to me, is really, of course, it's the foundation of the CE5 contact protocols, but it also explains a lot of what even military pilots that I've spoken to have experienced, where there's been an ET craft that appears. They will think something, like the Iranian case in 1976, where the man, the pilot of this Iranian F-16, was just thinking about arming the weapon system. And as he had the thought, the ETs took all those weapon systems offline electromagnetically and remotely, so he could not fire those missiles to destroy them. And that's a very well-known case, the Iranian. In fact, we have documents from the government stating that that case happened. But the way that it happened is not understood by many people, and that the ETs were basically able to pick up on his thought in a sense of remote view way. And people say, how could that happen? I say, well, all interstellar civilizations have electronics that can interface with coherent, directed thought. And this is, of course, the most astonishing part of all of this. And this is why people who've had really close encounters with ET vehicles, as opposed to something man-made by Lockheed Martin, they will have experiences that are also conscious and in thought and imagery. And the reason that happens is that any technologies that are communication systems that are phasing at multiples of the speed of light, which they have to, involve the stuff, if you will, of the visual thought matrix in consciousness. And that's to me, just so amazing and fascinating. And when people begin to really understand that and begin to learn techniques where they can experience it, it's really, there's no limit to what can happen.
Let me ask you a little bit, just on the topic of Iran, a little bit briefly. There was this interesting claim a couple of years ago. We had Mehran Kesh on the program. He mentioned that he had actually helped the Iranians to develop pretty much a flying saucer. To what capacity, though, this was able to move around and everything else hasn't been revealed, of course, but what's your take on that? Do you think we're capable of building something similar to what you're talking about?
Well, certainly that's what I was saying. We certainly have built, beginning in the 40s and 50s, experimentally, so-called flying saucers and anti-gravity vehicles. And as you know, if you go to our website, we have materials up there from people who actually were at Norton Air Force Base before it was decommissioned in the 80s, where there were three of these man-made, very UFO-looking aircraft that were the early models from the 60s, 50s, and 60s that were in sort of an aerospace museum at this covert facility, and they were just hovering above the floor. And I think one was about 25 feet across, one was 50, and another one was quite large, about 100 feet across. Mm-hmm. And, the startup power systems for those were a 24-volt marine battery. It would go into the zero-point energy field. It would go through a series of coils that caused the mass cancellation so that these objects would, quote, levitate or float. And they were just sitting in the hangar, floating above the hangar floor perpetually. And I personally met a man who was in there with when Frank Carlucci was in there at the same time, observing these. Hmm. So is that possible? Absolutely. Not only is it possible, there's no question in my mind it's been done. Whether or not this was done and the Iranians were experimenting with this, it's possible. I don't know. I mean, what I know are the folks that I have firsthand knowledge of and schematics for and documents for, and that's what Disclosure Project has done. I personally have not been able to visit with Mr. Keshi or see anything that has been built by his group, and we've been in touch, but so far we haven't been able to actually meet to evaluate anything, and that's of course what we require the ability to actually evaluate something that's in this in the real world operational and functional.
Yeah.
The key point is that there are many witnesses that we have in Disclosure Project and documents, not just from the United States, but from around the world, that this was an area of active research all the way back, if you will, to the late 20s with T. Townsend Brown, where he was doing things with very high voltage systems and crystalline materials that resulted in things that would float and levitate. And in Germany, around that same time, there was the Kolaski-Frost experiment that was on the cover of a physics journal, where it showed this object floating. So the laws of the universe are universal. And when I say that, I mean it quite literally, that whatever has been discovered by civilizations going way back on Earth, okay, but also out in other star systems, can be discovered by humans and have been. The problem has been that these big breakthroughs that have been going on for 100 years keep getting kept suppressed, and there's this very brutal buzzsaw of secrecy. Now, when you go back to, say, 1951, there's a document from Canada. It's also on our website, seriousdisclosure.com, that talks about the, and it's called the Wilbur Smith document. And it was a man, it was a top secret document that I understand was accidentally declassified in Canada in the 70s. The key points of the Wilbur Smith document is from in 1951, it states in this top secret memo in the Canadian government that there was a highly classified group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush, who is the same man who headed up the Manhattan Project to create the atomic bomb, to study the, quote, modus operandi, in other words, the mechanism of action of the UFOs that had been observed and retrieved in the desert southwest in the 40s, and that this project was the most highly classified project in the history of the United States government, exceeding, and it says this explicitly, exceeding the secrecy surrounding the development of the hydrogen bomb. Now, back in those days, this was just before we had perfected, for lack of a better word, the hydrogen bomb as opposed to the atomic bomb. The hydrogen bomb, of course, is fusion that's kicked off by an atomic bomb. And they're thermonuclear, much more destructive than just what we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And of course, the development of that next step of a fusion bomb was the most top secret program that anyone knew of. But that the work being done on these anti-gravity and UFO energy systems exceeded the secrecy of the ultimate doomsday weapon. So what people have to understand is that, you know, this document is a smoking gun, and it absolutely states what other documents we have and other witnesses that we have state, that the secrecy around this issue is so extraordinary because the technologies would enable the entire civilization to throw Bretton Woods away and the petrodollar away and oil and gas and coal and nuclear power away, and we would have what Tesla told everyone we had, and that is this infinite sea of energy that we could tap into for peaceful energy generation without pollution at zero cost. Once you had the generator there, of course, you'd have to buy something like a heat pump generator, but it would pull energy out of the zero-point energy field, and off you go. So this, of course, is something that when you look at the fact that there are hundreds of trillions of dollars in commodities that are traded and utilities and internal combustion engines and people and corporations that own oil fields and coal mines and uranium and power plants and jet engines, all of that would be obsolete. So I think what people need to understand is that the secrecy has been driven primarily by this macroeconomic conundrum. And the conundrum is, we need to make this next step and bring these sciences out for peaceful energy use. But if we do so, the people who are, as it were, in the catbird seat running the geopolitical power system would have to understand that their power would be dispersed to the people, because it literally and figuratively would be a dispersal of this centralized power that we live under today, where, you know, there's 200 or 300 corporations and individuals, it's not a conspiracy theory, it's an economic fact, that have over half of the net worth of the world, and that there's this sort of macroeconomic slavery that we're living under. And this is what the Honorable Paul Hellyer and I spoke about some years ago when he was first stepping out on this subject, the former Canada Minister of Defense. And he's a wonderful man. I've visited him at his home, and we've spent a great deal of time together. And he has told me that he thinks this is exactly correct. It's the macroeconomic and power dynamic control issues around disclosing this issue. Because if you disclose that the UFOs are real, and that these extraterrestrial civilizations are real. Anyone's going to ask the question, well, how did they get here? And what's the science behind those things that people have filmed and see and that we have photos of? Well, once that gets asked in a serious way, no pun intended, what happens at that point is that the public are going to go, well, this is, you know, what we want. This is, I mean, even, you know, Joe Sixpack with his pickup truck that gets 12 miles per gallon would be thilled to have an electric engine in there and motor with a generator pulling energy out of the zero-point field so he doesn't have to spend $100 to fill the tank up. But the problem becomes the folks don't want that out because the whole world we have are built around two big issues. One is conflict and war. The other is this macroeconomic petrodollar-based system. And both of those are so entrenched that people don't want to see it change. So the secrecy around UFOs and ETs, and this is what we go through in the film Sirius, really has to do with those issues more than anything. Now, it may have been back in the 30s and 40s that people in the national security apparatus didn't know what they were dealing with. They didn't know how the public would respond. They saw the panic with the War of the Worlds stuff, they may have been concerned. In 2013, since almost two-thirds of the public believe that there's intelligent life out in space somewhere, and actually 43% of the public believe that we're being visited actively by them. This is in a recent poll that came out this year. I don't think anyone's going to be in such a state of shock over the fact that there's intelligent life out there that has found our little corner of the cosmos. I think the bigger problem becomes if you start discussing these technologies, you're way beyond a rocket and way beyond a jet engine. And so then you're in a whole new macroeconomic world.
Let's just talk a little bit about what has happened then in the many years now that has gone by in terms of the, you know, promises and clues and suggestions, theories and everything else regarding so-called free energy. I mean, I remember you were talking about devices was almost 10 years ago now, 2001 and beyond, further than that. There is a lot of frustration regarding the clues and, sometimes the promises that have been made that is yet to deliver something tangible because we don't have anything in this area. What is going on? Why is it taking so long? Where are all these devices and things? You know?
Well, that's we've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to go around the world looking for these and providing grants to people to develop them. And what we've discovered is that either people can't do what they say they're going to do, or there are folks who can who end up getting threatened and end up abandoning the project. Believe me, there's no one on earth more frustrated than I am with this. And the dynamic is very frustrating because ultimately, if someone has something that begins to be operational, they get the buzzsaw thrown at them. They have the whole national security state, not here, but anywhere in the world. They're going to come after those folks. This is why we've decided the only way this is likely to happen, unless someone somehow manages to develop this on their own and can get it to us so we can get it out. I mean, we launched a whole global disclosure movement. I have no question we could get something like this out if it's legitimate. The problem is many of the inventors don't want to cooperate with the transparency needed to test it and reproduce it, in which case you don't have anything. You can't tell people there's a black box here. This is the problem they're going through right now with Rossi over in Italy. Oh, well, he has a cold fusion thing. Well, but the people testing it aren't allowed to know what it's doing. If you can't reproduce it, that's the sine qua non of science. So that's what we run into. On the one end, you have people who develop these technologies who don't want to do what is necessary to prove them. On the other hand, and there you do have those people who are complete, you know, actually hoaxing these technologies out there. Then you have the folks who are willing to get it to the next step, and then they get a visit by someone who threatens them or buys them out. Now, you know, Dr. Tom Beard and I talked about this. Many of the folks and devices like this that begin the service, they disappear, and they don't disappear so much into some sort of threatening matrix, but into something where, as he told me once, there was a man that had one of these devices. He had tested it. It was legitimate. The guy disappeared. Next thing he knows, the guy is wearing Armani suits and has millions of dollars. And this is someone who didn't have a pot to pee in, proverbially.
Any names we can put to that?
not this particular guy. But, you know, the point is this has happened over and over and over and over and over again. So how are you going to break this cycle? If you don't if you don't learn from history, you're going to repeat it. So over the last decade, what we've learned is that, yes, we provided grants to people. They either couldn't do it because they needed more technical and security support, or they began to hit pay dirt and they ended up getting threatened. And that's happened in the last few years. And so what we've concluded is that we're going to have to develop an energy research facility. It's going to have good security. It needs to be live streamed onto the onto the internet in a very transparent way. And it's got to be staffed up with people who can all pitch in from different disciplines, because you're dealing with very high voltage systems that, while complex on one, they're simple on one level to comprehend, but actually getting things to work properly under a controlled fashion that's safe is a lot of engineering. So this is not like developing an iPhone app, which you can do, you know, at your desk and then put it on the internet. This is some serious physics. And so we've concluded that that's the way to go forward, because we've tried this other way and it hasn't worked. And it hasn't worked for reasons that we felt probably wouldn't happen, but there was, that was all the resources we had.
And let me ask you this then, Stephen, considering what we've seen government do in the past with, you know, David Koresh and all these, you know, atrocities where people's houses, fortifications in some cases are simply raided. They're, you know, they drive tanks in through the in through the walls if they have to, and they create any kind of scenario surrounding that to be able to discredit this in terms of the other people who might be sitting and watching this on the media. There's, I mean, we're dealing with people who have atom bombs at their disposal and they're willing and ready to drop them. How is this helping with security and on that level? Do you see what I mean?
I think the difference is that what we did with Disclosure Project, when we went forward with that 12 years ago, it reached hundreds of millions of people around the world. We put all this in and then we released it to the public, and it was covered. Now, the internet at the time was nowhere near as developed then as it is now. What we could do now is, if we had the funding in place, and this is the big if, because I don't see, you know, right now we do not have it. The purpose for this film, Sirius, is to try to educate people and to create the funding base so we can open a proper lab. I mean, I just tweeted while your computer system went down that it's really kind of tragic that we can spend $50 or $60 million on IRS parties and conviviality, and we can't get 10% of that to do a serious research and development project on zero point energy. But, you know, this says something about our society, frankly. But if we can reach that point of support and do this properly, I think that it has to be done where, to use an old slogan, the whole world's watching, and you stream it and you have lots of people. You do not do a Silicon Valley secret type thing. You do not do this in a black box. And I think that, if anything, we prove that that can work like it did with Disclosure Project, because there are too many people who have the information and it gets out there and it's being seen. And I think that's how we need to do this R&D effort. And the other point I make to people is that we have collected information, designs, materials that, if there were skilled engineers who could do some iterative back and forth, proper scientifically controlled experiments, I don't think you're talking about a 5 or 10 year R&D program. I think you're talking 1 to 2 years before you would have an operational prototype that would prove the principle and have this out. And at that point, it wouldn't be a black box. It would be done in a way that we would be asking universities and other people we have very good contacts with to recreate the effect and put it out there as open source as possible. Because I think that if it's done the other way, the proof is, if you go the patent route, it's going to get seized through a national security order. If you don't go the patent route, they can still come in with a national security order and take it. All right. So the question becomes, how do you do this when you have this overweening, abusive national security state, which I agree with you, will do anything including breaking the law and subverting our liberties to get their own way. And by the way, it's not just like this in the United States. It's also like this in Russia and Great Britain. People who worked on this in Brazil have run into the same buzzsaw because there is a transnational super state that is keeping this stuff under wraps. And a lot of people say, oh, why don't you go to this country or that country? I said it wouldn't matter because unless you have the public knowledgeable and following what you're doing and supporting it, and you do this in any dark corner of the planet, these guys are going to find you before the public will, and you're a dead man. So I think one of the real issues becomes how do you learn from the last 50 to 80 years of secrecy and what are the mistakes that have been made? And actually, over the last decade, our intention about a decade ago was to develop, have enough resources so we could do what I've just described. But we never were able to raise that level of funding, so we did what we could. And we knew that that was a far riskier and less likely successful outcome, but we didn't want to just do nothing. So that's what we did. At this point, the reason that Sirius was conceived of, and I know that the director and I talked about this, was to build awareness and to advance disclosure, but also to help have a mechanism to attract and create the funding needed for us to bring these science and technologies forward in a properly supported research laboratory. And I don't think that anyone has ever done that, because if it had been done, we'd know about it. I know of attempts where actually 10 times the amount that we're seeking have been raised with private equity, but they've been done in a Silicon Valley way, very secretively, and those all end up disappearing. And that's one of the concerns I have. I keep seeing the same pattern repeating.
Well, let me ask you this as we move ahead here a little bit. Then the proceeds of the film are going to help to set up this energy lab that you're talking about. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, our goal is that if we can raise the funds, and we're about ready to put up a budget and a two-year plan and budget for it, it'd be around $6.3 million, and which would be a staff of 18 to 20 people and a facility and the right equipment and what have you. And, you know, whether or not, if we can't reach that point, we'll continue to do educational programs until we do reach that point. We're hoping that it can be a combination of people who want to put larger sums in, as well as the public putting in just small amounts like we did with the film. I mean, one of the wonderful things about the film Sirius is that the public supported it. It's the most successful crowdfunded film in the history of crowdfunding, like Kickstarter, and for a documentary. And so we're hoping that we can do the same thing with the film and raising the awareness. And if we fall short of that, obviously one of the problems becomes, when I've spoken to people who are engineers and project managers and what have you, they're not going to leave their career track positions at an engineering firm to work for 2 months on something. So you need to have a two-year budget. You need to have a facility where they can work. You need to have security. You need to have the right equipment. And one of the problems with the equipment, just I don't get too far into the technical weeds here, but to anyone listening who has an electromagnetic engineering background, most of the things that are very highly effective are in the tens of thousands to millions of volts, but at very low current. So the power is very small, but it's very high voltage at certain resonant frequencies and harmonics that create a pointing vector, as it were, into the zero-point energy field that creates this over-unity or free energy effect. We understand this very well, and it can be done. Well, Stan Meyer was doing it through water, with the water system, where he could dissociate the H2O bond into hydrogen and oxygen and run a car on that gas with no pollution. You can do it with crystalline structures. You can do it with modern nanocrystalline structures, which is what Dr. Bearden was experimenting with his so-called MEG. You can do it with other materials and coils, as well as magnetically charged fluids that are in a toroid-shaped object. And these are all things that we've looked into that have either been confiscated or had national security orders on them, or have just died with the inventor because he did not leave full specifications for anyone to follow up on, in the case of, say, Stan Meyer. So I think that that's one of the things that we would be focusing on, but it means that you have to have highly specialized equipment, which means you have to build out a laboratory, you have to get equipment that is custom-made because as you know, I mean, your computer and your, you know, maybe you have 220 in your house, but you're using 110 or 220. This is household current. This is a very different bird altogether when you start dealing with how these, when you look at a UFO that's levitating, the amount of voltage that you're involving there is millions of volts. Now, it may be at relatively low power because you're getting this energy flow from, well, Dr. Dirac, we call it the Dirac C. Others call it the quantum vacuum or zero point field. But once you have that energy flowing, it does become so-called over-unity, where you're pulling more energy out than you have to manually put in. And it does conserve the laws of thermodynamics because what people don't account for is this infinite sea of energy that Nikola Tesla talked about, who I believe was the great genius of the 20th century more than Einstein or anyone else. But I think that this requires highly specialized equipment and people who know what they're doing with it, okay, as well as, certain safety procedures in place. And you can do it. I mean, certainly there are other people who have stumbled across this effect. A lot of people don't know the backstory of how Stan Meyer got water to dissociate into hydrogen and oxygen. He was working at a radar plant and noticed that under certain voltages, because of the energies used in these radar systems, water, there was some water that spilled, suddenly became gaseous very, very quickly at very low amounts of power. And he realized it was the voltage combined with the frequency that caused that to happen. And so he and his twin brother, Steve, began to experiment with that and came up with, of course, his water fuel cell. Mm-hmm. And we understand this. And so once you understand the principles, if you have a properly equipped lab and people educated in these concepts, there's an iterative process where you would hit that sweet spot even if they're not in Stan Meyer's patents, because he deliberately left that secret part of the recipe out, which was, of course, a big mistake, because then once he passed away, everyone who's tried to reproduce it from his patents hasn't been successful. But once you understand the principles, then you can do that, but you need to have proper equipment and workstations and all this. A lot of people, you see on the internet, there are these people who fantasize, well, you can just kind of make this up and, have a mothership land and hand one off. Well, this is not how the world works. So living in the real world for one nanosecond, you actually have to do this in a way that is a scientific, methodical fashion. And there's no reason we can't do that. We do it all the time for other things that are really quite trivial, such as video games and what have you. Mm-hmm. I knew this one guy who wrote out on the back of an envelope a concept he had for a smartphone video game system and got $15 million in venture capital funding for this idea. And I was just so astonished. I mean, the amount of money that floats around. But when you present these ideas, the people with big money go, oh, well, that can't be possible. And when you show the documentation, it has been done. And then they'll go, well, it might be dangerous. And, there are all kinds of reasons people back out of this situation. So mm-hmm. I think it's more likely, in my opinion, that the public can get educated about this and support it. And if they don't, I guess we'll continue to use fossil fuels until both polar ice caps melt or something. But I think that, I hate to say it that way, but I mean, at a certain point, people, it's an educational process to have people realize that this is not only feasible to do, but we can combine our resources and do it if we determine that it's a priority. Unfortunately, it has not been a priority. Most people who look into these matters just want to be entertained with, frankly, shock and drivel on the internet. And I think that what we have to do is begin to say, are we serious about this or not? And if we are, let's get serious about it. And serious about it doesn't mean a few thousand dollars. You're not going to do anything with a few thousand dollars. And if someone does have something that's operational, great. But so far, every time we hear about it, it's sort of a mirage that evaporates in the desert, except for the ones that have been quite legitimate, and those folks end up getting, as I said, it's the lone wolf, and you can pick off one person at a time. I think a larger team where you have the whole public involved in watching it, a lot of shows like yours could have a link into Ustream or whatever and seeing the lab and the work being done. I think you do this in as public a way as you possibly can. And I think the mistake that's been made every time we've looked into it is, I hate to use the word, but the inventor secrecy that surrounds these sort of breakthroughs is the Achilles heel.
Well, I sincerely hope that we will get to see something in this area develop in one fashion or another, and as many different avenues as possible to be explored in order to move forward in some way. Let's talk about some of the more controversial aspects, Stephen. Curious to hear your take on some of this. Tell us about the one of the bigger pieces in the movie, of course, the Atacama humanoid as featured in the film. There's quite a debate raging about this on the web right now as well. There's been suggestions that it's been over sensationalized for marketing purposes and stuff like that. What's your take on this, Dan?
Well, actually, we didn't over sensationalize it at all. The Huffington Post picked up on the fact that this unusual remains, it's a physical body that's about 6 inches tall, was included as part of the movie. It's only a small part of the movie, and made a very large story out of it. So we didn't sensationalize it at all. However, the Huffington Post did. And that had something like 4 million people look at that story, and it went crazy. What we've always said is that we don't know what it is. Now, the other part of it is that once the studies were done at Stanford, I was one of the first people to handle this particular creature some years ago, about 3 or 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until late September of 2012, that the people who actually have this specimen in Barcelona, Spain, allowed us to take physical samples and proper x-rays and CAT scans. So we went over there and did that. Now, what we did, we clipped the anterior right ribs and took off two pieces of bone, and inside there was very good bone marrow, so we could do DNA studies. But more importantly, the head of the world's expert in skeletal abnormalities and dysplasia, Dr. Ralph Lockman, gave us a list of exactly which angles we needed for the CAT scan and the regular x-rays for him to do a proper evaluation to see if it matched to any known deformity of a human. And he looked at them and he concluded a couple of astonishing things. Number one, and this is, if you go to seriousdisclosure.com, you can click on Atacama. I have a whole report there. Everyone can see the x-rays. Everyone can see Lockman's report, Dr. Lockman at Stanford. Everyone can see the MRI scan in 3D. It's there for anyone to see. So, and there's a full report written if you can read it. It's in English. So it's there for anyone to look at. Now, when he looked at it and he began, of course, he said to me exactly what the head of the radiology clinic in Barcelona said, Dr. Manchon, and it was at the Manchon clinic. And she said, look, this is not a fetus. This is several years old. I don't know exactly, but it's a very tiny, but it is not a fetus. Now, it's the size of a 15 to 20 week fetus. And so people just looking at this, the physical specimen would conclude that, which an early medical doctor did, because he didn't do the x-rays and CAT scans. When Dr. Lockman looked at them, he said, well, look at the epiphyseal plates, which is the growth plates in the bones. This is a 6 to 8 year old child. So then the question becomes clinically, how does a 6 to 8 year old child live? In 100 to 1,000 years ago, we're not sure exactly how old this specimen is, in this driest place on Earth, in the Atacama Desert, without any medical facilities, because I mean, in an ICU today, you'd be hard pressed to keep something this small alive for more than a couple of hours. So the question really becomes, what is this? And so it's more of a mysterious finding now than it was a year ago, actually. And one of the problems is that, of course, the media and the internet has, it's all rumor mill and journalists who don't have a science background. And when the geneticist did a first pass through on the genetics, just running it through a computerized database, it had a lot of human genes that were matching. Well, that would make sense if it's an upright creature walking around that was somehow living on the earth. The question becomes, what is it? And as he looked at the areas of the genes that control for dwarfism, very short size, or progeria, rapidly aging, that would explain something being 6 inches tall and 6 to 8 years old, none of those genes were abnormal. And 9% of the genetic material, which is 2 million base pairs, it could be 2,000 or 3,000 genes, are not matching to human. Now, at this point, he doesn't know whether that's a computer error, a sampling error, a what's called junk DNA, which now they're discovering junk DNA is actually operative under certain conditions. It's called epigenetics, or what? And nobody knows, because to go through those 2 million base pairs has to be done manually by multiple teams of scientists. So the hard part is just now starting. Now, unfortunately, because, you know, I mean, being a Stanford geneticist, Dr. Nolan had to say, well, you know, this has human DNA in it, and it's deformed from anything you would expect. And so the journalist saw that and said, well, case closed, it's a deformed human. Well, that's not true at all. He doesn't believe that. No one believes that. So
hasn't he said conclusively that it is human now, though, the last update from Nolan?
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
He's saying that, look, there's no database of extraterrestrial genetics. The only database we have are human.
Wait just a minute.
Yeah, so you're not going to have a scientist at Stanford say this is ET. All he's saying is that there is human genetic material in it, but there's 9% that is unmatched, and we have no idea what's in that unmatched DNA. Now, in between the lines, let's look at that. You and I are 99.5% identical to a Neanderthal, and chimpanzees are 96 to 97% identical to you and me. If half of this 9% unmatched DNA are actual controlling operative genes, because we got a very good DNA sample and it was extracted under the most professional conditions at Stanford and run at the best labs, that's a 4 to 5%, which is more than the difference between you and me and a chimp. So we don't know. I can tell you Dr. Nolan doesn't know what this is. Dr. Ralph Nachman doesn't know what it is. No radiologist and no scientist has looked at it. The problem is in the lexicon, because when you're dealing with these Ivy League institutions, these guys are not going to call this anything other than the presumptive default position is that it's a human, all right? Mm-hmm. They have to work from that.
Yeah.
But they will admit that nobody knows what it is, because there's no genetic syndrome that matches. There's no genes that would control for this kind of extreme dwarfism for 6 to 8 year olds that are being found abnormal. There's 9% of the genetic material not matching. And to go through all those 2 million base pairs is going to be years and years of research, because there's no computerized database. The easy part's been done, because it was run through a computer system matching against these 2,500 ethnic types around the world to see what matches and what doesn't. Now it's the hard part. And the hard part is something that could take years to do. And this is something that just completely didn't get caught. Now, we have just done an update, and if you go to our website, there's a link to something up on YouTube that's an update of me going through all this analysis for anyone who wants to look at it on the Atacama humanoid. And it's there for anyone to look at, and it's free for anyone to look at. So I think that then you have to add into this another conundrum. We have now found that there are people in Chile who may have another one of these in Santiago. And there's a creature that was in Russia in 96 that I almost got to go see, but it was confiscated by someone before we got there, that looks very similar but a little more mature, may have been an adult version of this creature. And then there are accounts also coming out of Puerto Rico of small, maybe foot high or less creatures that have been seen. So if all of that is true, and this is what Dr. Nolan and others have admitted, if there's more than one of these, then it kind of precludes a one-off unique genetic defect. And now you're talking about a different species. And then you start adding in the clinical picture that where these particular life forms have been seen living in Chile is also associated with objects that are these luminous spheres that go in and out of the mountains, like you were discussing at Linville Falls, a gorge. And so the question becomes, there are many more questions than there are answers. And so how are you going to get to the bottom of this? Well, you're going to have to do a lot of digging and research. And that's what we're just starting on the process of doing. The reason we included it in the movie was because once we found that the world's expert on skeletal abnormalities, Dr. Lockman, who literally wrote the textbook on this and is a Stanford professor, when he stated that this is, without a question, a 6 to 8 year old, and other radiologists also said that, then you have to ask, how did this live? What kind of species is this? It's hard for me to imagine a human giving birth to this and it living for 6 to 8 years in the primitive conditions in that part of the world as a really massively deformed human that was that tiny, because we can't keep a newborn that's that small alive today with our high-tech neonatal intensive care technologies. So it becomes this, the clinical picture has really at this point gone way ahead of the genetic picture, because the genetic picture is going to require perhaps dozens or hundreds of scientists picking through this trash bin, as they call it, of 2 million base pairs of genetic material that was tossed out by the computer. So I think that is something that people have to understand. And of course, everyone wants it. They think it's the drive-thru at McDonald's where you order this and you get an answer. Well, that's not how science goes forward.
Well, of course not. I mean, we've talked about other very similar. This case sounds very much like the Star Child skull that Lloyd Pye has been the caretaker of. We've talked about it before on the program. And he has also been involved in trying to extract the DNA, trying to determine what it is. And this has proven to be a very time-consuming effort. So is it a similar scenario? What's needed to find out so we can know what it is? What do you think?
Well, I think it's a very different thing. Here we have a whole entire body, okay? And you also are getting reports of others that are similar to it. So there may be more to follow up on in this case. And the other thing I point out to people, which I didn't mention before, if you look at the CAT scan, most people I know don't know how to read them, but you can clearly see there's organs inside the chest cavity. So you can see the collapsed lungs. You can see the little bit of what's left of a heart. It's an entirely intact organism. There's no question it's not a hoax or a fraud or anything of that sort. It was also stated on the record. And it's in the film, Sirius, stated this way by the scientist at Stanford, by Dr. Nolan. The bigger question is, how do you do this? I mean, I point out to folks, it took billions of dollars and hundreds of scientists 10 years to go out and map the 20, 30,000 genes in the Human Genome Project. Here we have perhaps 2,000 or 3,000 genes that are going to have to be run to ground, and I won't bore you with the details of how you do that. You actually have to isolate things that look like they're in operative genetic groups and then put them in what are called mouse studies. But we don't know if those would be relevant if it's not a human species or even something that originated on Earth. It's a daunting task. And the frustration that we have as scientists is that everyone wants to reach a facile, instantaneous answer. And what we say in the film and what I say consistently is that nobody has any idea what this is. To do the kind of research that's needed well beyond our resources financially. What we're hoping to do and what the Stanford folks are hoping to do is to open up the database of this genetic material to hundreds of PhD geneticists around the world and have them start diving into it and see if they find anything.
Yeah, you mentioned that other one from Santiago. I remember that too. 2002, I think it was, came out reports of this very tiny little humanoid. It's about 7.2 centimeters long. It looked definitely more kind of beaten up, for lack of a better term, than the one that I've seen photographs of in terms of what you have. But then there was this other one as well. Did you see this one? The photographs from that shows Ripley from Ripley's Believe It or Not holding his own Atacama humanoid called the Attaboy. Did you see that one?
Yeah, we have seen that, but who knows? I mean, you know, this is another case where, because it was so many years ago and we don't know where the specimen, you know, is, it's intriguing. And of course, at that time, they said, well, it must be a shrunken human. Well, now you shrink something to that size. But there's all kinds of questions about that. What I think might be more promising from some researchers I've talked to who've been on the ground in this part of Chile is that there are some areas where there were some old mining operations from the 1800s where they actually cut into what appear to be subterranean, like little cities, miniature villages that would be the size for these creatures. And if true, that's an interesting archaeological expedition. But of course, now you're talking about going all the way to Chile with a team of archaeologists, ground-penetrating radar and sonar, this, that, and the other thing. I mean, you would need the funding from the Smithsonian Institution to do this. And, of course, no one wants to fund this kind of research. If we had, I'm always joking, you know, and my big joke in this since the last week or two is that if we had a fraction of what the IRS spends on parties and lame dancing videotape training lessons for their employees, we would be able to solve all these mysteries very quickly and bring out the technologies to the world. But, of course, you know, there's an infinite amount of waste that can go into frivolity and nonsense, and when you want to do something like this, there seems to never be any funding. But at any rate, that's the situation. And, you know, certainly if a team could be assembled and funded to go down there, it would be an exciting expedition to go on. And I know that geneticists and other scientists are willing to do it, because I think there may be more where this one came from. And I think ultimately, you know, the genetic material, I don't know that that's ever going to give us an answer. I think we may end up 5 years from now with 9% of this material unmatching that no one can figure out what it would do. And if that's the case, then it's not a 99% match to humans. It's a 91% match to humans, which means that it is very different from a human. And you can call it human-like, but then the question is, what is it?
I wanted to shift over a little bit here then. We sure. were, you know, talking about the Atacama humanoid and wanted to get into one of the other aspects in the movie as well, which is the CE5 initiative that deals with some of the contact things as well. Just explain this a little bit for people who don't know what this is.
Well, it's a really, to me, the reason I got involved with this whole subject. And when I was 18, I had a close encounter of the fifth kind contact experience, and it was mediated through an experience in higher consciousness. And it happened in the mountains of North Carolina. You mentioned that earlier. And it was really an amazing experience for me personally. But what it taught me was that interstellar civilizations have innate abilities that some would use the word telepathic. I don't really like that word. But also have technologies that interface with clear, coherent thought. Now, what the Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind initiative is at its core is a citizens' diplomatic initiative, much like the Physicians for Social Responsibility that went over to the Soviet Union during the darkest days of the Cold War to try to create a sort of a rapprochement between the Soviets and America, even though our government was dug in the darkest days of the Cold War. What we're looking at is how do we turn a more enlightened face towards these interstellar visitors, all of them, without prejudice, and say there are people on this planet who are wanting to look forward to a time of universal peace, of us going into space not with weapon systems and with sort of a Star Wars shoot 'em up mentality, but leaving that whole paradigm of duality behind for the next half a million years at least, and go forward into a period of universal peace and be on the vanguard of creating that change. And one of the fascinating things is that when you learn how to go into deep meditative states and then learn to remote view and see remote places with the faculty of consciousness, you learn that this is something that every human being can develop. Many people have had lucid precognitive dreams, and some people have had telepathic or precognitive or intuitive experiences in their life. Most people have had some kind of experience like that. But there are ways to make that routinely reproducible. And so one of the things I've tried to do is to teach people meditation techniques and remote viewing training techniques. And these are all actually available on the internet now on smartphone apps. There's an Android and iPhone app that you can get through our website, seriousdisclosure.com, and put it on your phone. It has the whole meditation training program. It has the protocols for what we call coherent thought sequencing. And what that involves is that we go out and we use a combination of electronic tones, which are also in this app, that you can project out into space that gives a linear vector of where you are. We usually have a high-powered laser we send out also to show a linear point. But then we do these experiences in consciousness of deep meditation, remote viewing, and then we turn it around to where we're not only remote viewing where the ET civilizations or craft or people might be, but also where we turn it around and show them where we are. And we do this in what I call coherent thought sequencing, where basically it's done from deep consciousness when you're in a very relaxed state, and it's a flow of consciousness that visually shows precisely where you are. So let's say you're sitting up on a mountain in North Carolina. You would, once you had a remote view of a spacecraft or an extraterrestrial person or a planet, you would then invite them and show them where you are and begin to vector, as it were, through consciousness and thought. Now, the reason we call it coherent thought is that it's coming from a deep, relaxed state, and it's a very clear, directed intent. And what we have discovered, and this is in the research, if you study UFO encounter reports going back, you know, 50, 60, 80 years, is that often when people have had encounters with the spacecraft or the beings, they will notice that they are not only highly telepathic, but they'll usually have some kind of electronic box or object that is clearly either both transmitting and receiving thought energy. Now, we think of electromagnetic signals because we're always talking on phones and cell phones, but imagine if there was a way to routinize, as it were, or to reproduce this effect using coherent thought. So that's what we're doing, although we don't have that technology, but the ETs do. Because why? Because if you're traveling faster than the speed of light, your transmission electronic systems have to cross over the light barrier into these other dimensions, which are increasingly associated with the visual aspect of thought and coherent thought, what the mystics used to call astral, like when you have a flying lucid dream. And most people have had a dream like that where they're flying and it's full color. And that kind of energy field is actually an area of discovery in physics. And now it may be something that's relegated now to mysticism, but of course a smartphone would be mystical to Thomas Jefferson, whose house is down the road from where my farm is here in Virginia. So I tell people that the reality is that we have to open our minds to the idea that there are technologies that can interface with coherent thought, and that is how these civilizations are being able to communicate and interact with us. And so that's what we utilize as a group. So we'll go out with a team of people, and we'll set up the electronics and also set up the meditation and invite them in a spirit of universal peace to visit us. And we're never disappointed. They may not come and fully into this dimension, but there's always some kind of amazing contact phenomenon, whether it's electronic, tonality, sound, spheres, the kind of things you were describing at Linville that happen that are around us that are really quite amazing. And I think that more importantly, when you have a lot of people doing this, and now there are thousands of teams all over the world doing this, it creates what Rupert Sheldrake called this morphogenic field shift, where as more as like the 100th monkey effect, where more and more people begin to do something, it potentiates that positive change in society. And so that's a very important part of what we're doing as well.
Very good. Now, some people are very disappointed with this approach. They, you know, they want to have the physical contact. They want to have meetings in the flesh, if you know what I mean. Will this ever be achieved in any way, in your view?
Well, it's likely it will at some point. And I think that the question is under what conditions and with whom. Yeah. We have had experiences like that, actually, where we have been out and people have been physically touched very quickly, or where beings have appeared and then disappeared, where a whole group of people have seen them fully materialized, where we've had craft that have been fully materialized and come over and then disappeared. The question is how fleeting it is and what people's expectations are and what are the conditions. One of the problems I've run into is that every time, if you look at the film, serious, I don't know if you had a chance to see it, is that at one point we were out about a year ago out in Colorado, and there was this disc that came floating right over us, and within seconds there were actually two military jets that turned and vectored straight in towards it, and then it sort of made a quick arc and dematerialized in the sky right above us. And one of the interesting pictures that were taken, it's not in the film, is this object almost making like a quick circle and then vanishing in one frame. of the film. But that happens, I think, because, you know, I think that the classified programs really don't want this to get too far out there to where you would have an uncontrollable situation that would take place. And we found that, you know, just as there's energy suppression, there's attempts to suppress the E5 events from becoming too demonstrable. But it doesn't mean they can't happen. And people have to think, well, it may happen in many, many different ways, and you have to be open to that depending on what your readiness is, what the ET's readiness is, and what's going on with military programs that are monitoring our airspace and or the space around the Earth. Because it's not like all this that we're doing is happening in a vacuum that we can control. It's happening in a place that is in transition, let's call it that. And the Earth is a place very much in transition. So I think what people have to do is to prepare for all possibilities. And ultimately, the only thing that we can control is to prepare ourselves for contact, be in the correct ethical frame of mind that's peaceful, understand and educate ourselves about all the different ways that ET civilizations might be able to appear, whether it be mental, plasma-like orbs, tonality, electromagnetic phenomena, what have you, or fully materialize and be prepared for that. And I think all we can do is control our inner lives and how we're operating as a group. The rest, you sort of have to give it to things that are not under our control. But if we understand how to do this, then no matter what happens, we're going to be prepared. And I think the ultimate preparation is to experience that state of consciousness that's very deep and what I call the universal translator, this non-local field of pure consciousness. Very Vedic in a way, but the concept is key, because only do people become calmer if an event starts happening, if they're in that state of mind, but they're also in the universal communicator, which is, as the physicist Erwin Schrodinger said, the total number of minds in the universe is one, and that is that mind is a singularity. I'm paraphrasing, but that's pretty much what he said. And interestingly, that's what Ben Rich said before he died, the head of the Lockheed Skunk Works, when he was talking to Jan Harzan, who is an IBM executive who I've worked with very closely, who's also in the film Sirius, where he said that, look, you know, Lockheed Skunk Works, we already have the means to take ET home. We can travel faster than the speed of light. But he also said that every point in space and time is connected to every other through mind and consciousness. And, you know, when you have senior aerospace people who've delved into this, understanding that, you know, I think it's time for the rest of the public to know this. And that's one of the things that we're trying to share in the film.
Very good. Let's squeeze in a couple of more questions here before we wrap things up. The film has gotten mixed reviews and reception, like any project these days. Are you happy with the movie, how it turned out? Has the movie managed to change the paradigm in any way and advance our understanding of this of these questions, Stephen?
Well, yes. I mean, we've been very pleased with it. I mean, you have to understand, the film is from the take of the filmmaker, who knew nothing about the subject before we met. And I think that it's taken from the point of view of someone discovering these issues. So, you know, many people who are aficionados of the UFO subculture say, well, I knew a lot of this. Well, yeah, but a lot of people on the street don't. So the film's intent was to open this up to a larger and larger number of people, which it is very much doing. I mean, you know, large numbers of people are learning about these things through the release of this film, and we think it's going to continue. We've only just begun the release process. It's only a month into it, and this is going to go through a series of distribution models and what have you over the next 6 months to a year. So the idea is that it's been actually more successful. I know the marketing guy who volunteered, who does a lot of big films for Hollywood, who worked with us, was a wonderful man, volunteered his time. He said he had never seen so much interest on any project he's worked on. And he's worked on the Star Wars films and Tom Cruise's films and all kinds of big Hollywood productions. So it has had an enormous effect, actually. And what I find is that part of it is that, you know, you can't be all things to all people. And so what the filmmaker wanted to do is to take the overall focus of contact and disclosure and these new energy issues and weave them into a narrative from his perspective of someone just exploring this. So, and I think he did an artful, and it's actually a very beautiful film. One of the things we're doing as a follow-up is to put up on our website a lot more documents and evidence and material that won't fit into an hour and 50-minute film. Because a feature film can only contain so much talking heads and documents and stuff. So what we're loading up is more and more of that kind of evidence and material. But what we have found is that most people want to be, you know, see things that are very concise and very short. And, you know, we live in the Twitter universe now where 142 characters is most people's attention span, unfortunately. But what we are doing is putting more and more of these interviews. So all these interviews we have with military people, we have something like 110 hours. So we're putting that on the YouTube channel, and also we're also putting it on links from our site, and then more and more of these government documents, more of the research we're doing on the Atacama humanoid, much more material than would fit in a film. So I view the film as a portal into further discovery and research by someone who would become interested. And so that's what we're trying to provide. Now, remember, we're doing all this with volunteer effort around the world and no paid staff. You know, everyone has this idea that somehow there's a huge office building full of people working with us. I mean, it's just silly. It's just a volunteer effort, and we're doing what we can as quickly as we can. But ultimately, I think there's a lot of material. If you go to seriousdisclosure.com and look at all the links and look at all the research papers and documents and interviews with military and other people and the material that's there that most people really don't know about. And I think that the film is a way of introducing the larger public, and not necessarily the UFO public, to the subject and to discovering the truth.
Very good. It's geared towards the newcomer, in other words. So let me ask you one more thing here. Another actually rumor that came our way. One of our listeners suggested in an email to us that there's been a fallout between people participating in the movie, the core group, if you will, on the basis of some disagreement. Is that true?
Oh, well, there's all kinds of internet gossip and nonsense that's out there, and it's just, I'm not going to go into it except to say, consider the source of that. And what I tell people is that this isn't about gossip, and, you know, everyone wants to get into sort of a soap opera of that. And
sure.
It's about the knowledge and the information, and it's frankly not about that, and frankly not about me. It's about, what are we as a people going to do to create a civilization that can go forward and make peaceful contact with these other civilizations? And, you know, we just kind of chuckle when we see the kind of things. You know, there was a whole thing up there, you know, my parents were reptilian and I'm a reptile. I mean, just, you know, I hate to say it, batshit crazy stuff. I
don't know. Sure.
But at the same time, you know, you expect that. I mean, there's, you know, my father-in-law used to say, paper doesn't refuse ink. Well, the internet doesn't refuse digits. So you can write and say anything.
Oh,
and,
of course, yeah.
But what I tell people is that, you know, there are thousands of people working all over the world who are the most wonderful folks I've ever met working on this. And some people like what we're doing and some people don't. That's fine. It's a free world.
That's
but,
the way it is. Yeah.
You know, I don't feel like, you know, we have to focus on every internet gossip and nasty thing that somebody wants to write that's false and defaming. And ultimately, what I've discovered with this is that the closer we get to reaching millions and millions of people with this information and the science and technology, the more the counterintelligence operatives stand up all kinds of outrageous nonsense. And this has happened for 20 years. I mean, I'll remind people that in 1992, when we were first launching Project Starlight, that began to brief people in 93 in the Clinton administration and others, there were folks who tried to stop what we were doing through all kinds of chicanery. And when we didn't do that, they released information through the early internet saying that I wasn't a medical doctor. I didn't have a medical degree. I'm literally working in North Carolina in an emergency department. I'm having to fax my medical license and what have you around to people because I was being accused of not even being a doctor. And, you know, so people will create any kind of crazy stuff. And I tell folks who want to be entertained with that kind of gossip, have at it. You know, we have bigger fish to fry. We have a world that's in meltdown. We have civilizations, multiple of them, visiting us, waiting for us to grow up and make peaceful contact. And we have technologies that are provably legitimate that have been suppressed for over 50 years that could give us a civilization without poverty. And, you know, if folks want to spend their energy on nastiness and acrimony, they can spend their time that way. I choose to do more productive things.
Well, indeed, fallacies and ad hominem attacks, it's commonplace due to disagreements primarily. But, you know, after all things are said and done, I do hope we see developments on the free energy front after, you know, so much struggle on this. And I hope we can see some development in terms of how this moves forward here. So very good.
Yeah, I would say it's up to the public. If the public want to support it, they will.
Yeah.
And if they don't, I wish everyone the best. If they're waiting for a large corporation or the president to release this information, they're going to wait until it's too late. So I would say we should all do what we can to do something constructive and positive for the world, and that's what we're doing.
Yeah, I hope there's inventors out there that just dares to do it on her own and spread as much as possible online to make it open source, as you said. That's kind of where some of this might lie. But let's wrap up here for this time. We appreciate having you on, answering some of the questions about the film that we had, and of course some of the other surrounding stuff to this. Give us the website again then, so people know where to go to find out more if they want to check this out for themselves.
Yeah, you can see the film there and also get these apps for the contact protocols and all the other material at SiriusDisclosure.com. It's all one word, SiriusDisclosure.com.
We have Maurice Cottrell, Penny Pierce, Allison Adams, Alan Abadesa, and many more coming up next on Red Ice Radio. Stay tuned to RedIceCreations.com for more radio programs and our news coverage on all the latest from PRISM and NSA's Edward Snowden and many more topics that we're following right now. Also check out our archives at redicemembers.com for our subscriptions. Have a great rest of your day. We will speak to you soon. Take care.